It's Paul Harris here with the Large Morning Show in the afternoon, Friday afternoons on the Big 550 KTRS. David Vondrell is joining me in the studio now. I read a book that he wrote over a decade ago about the 2000 election that was called Deadlock, which was just a phenomenal read about that unbelievable battle between Bush and Gore. He's written several books, and his latest is about another president, a little bit before our time. His name is Abraham Lincoln. And there's a lot now about Lincoln because Steven Spielberg's movie has become a hit and is nominated for every Academy Award that they can make a statue for. So David is out now with his new book, which is called Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. Welcome to the show, David. It's good to have you.
It's great to be here, Paul.
So the Spielberg movie takes place in the last few months of Lincoln's life, which puts it in 1865, the 13th Amendment, slavery ending, the Emancipation Proclamation, his inauguration, and assassination. You would think that that's the big year of his presidency, but you say no. In fact, it was much earlier.
I think 1862 is the year that Lincoln becomes the revered, you know, man of the marble statue that that we think of. As the year began, really none of the great statesmen of Europe, none of the experienced wise heads in Washington really believed that the Union could be saved. The South was so large, such a big piece of real estate. It was so it controlled the most valuable commodity in the world, cotton. They were so determined to leave. And here was this weak federal government being led by this unknown, unschooled frontier lawyer who seemed totally overwhelmed. There was a cabinet meeting on New Year's Eve, 1861, just before my year begins, when little by little the cabinet and congressional committee that was interviewing Lincoln realized that he didn't even know what the plans were for the Union Army. The General McClellan was keeping everything secret from him. The Attorney General said he's an honest guy, he's a man of character, but he lacks the power to command. And yet somehow through the course of this year, when America really did come within a hair's breadth of ending the American experiment, ending in failure, by the end of the year, Lincoln was signing the Emancipation Proclamation. He was in command of the army and of his own party and of his own cabinet, and he had really figured out how to lead this country through the ordeal.
When you say the American experiment ending, you mean we would have split in two, that the South secession would have gone forward, and that we would have not been the United States of America united in any way.
Yeah, well, what people in 1862 understood that we've kind of forgotten is there was nothing stable about North and South. That's the way it was split then. But folks out here in Missouri, Illinois, this area of the country, they had no real ties to the East. Their commercial ties were with the South down the Mississippi River. That's how their crops got to market. Out West, California, Oregon, these brand new states were connected to the East by nothing more than wagon ruts. And, you know, it took 3 months to get around Cape Horn to go from New York to San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So secession, if it got started, if the principle was vindicated by the South, it would have been a tiger that would bite in many directions.
Did Americans, you said the European leaders and others didn't believe that the Union could stand. Did Americans think that the Confederacy had a chance of winning that war?
I think there were, you see, a lot of people did. The ones who didn't think that that the South could win thought that the Civil War was going to be simple, that really most people in the South wanted to be in the Union, and it was just a few hotheads who had gotten control. They believed that one or two Union victories would break the South, you know, sort of cure the secession fever, and people, they'd come back. But in this year, 1862, we have the Battle of Shiloh in April, the first weekend of April, more Americans killed in that one battle than in all American wars put together. And a couple of months later, the 7 days battles, tens of thousands of Americans killed and wounded in the course of a week. And then September 17, the Battle of Antietam is the bloodiest day in American history before or since to this day. People, the war became a cataclysm. And in that point, Paul, lots of people began to say, wait a minute, what? Why are we doing this? And so there was this crisis of confidence, and Lincoln had to explain what was really at stake here.
So there were people in the North who kind of thought, this will be like a weekend. Mm-hmm. They thought it would be like their version of Grenada.
Yep,
all right,
exactly.
Call me on Monday, it'll be over,
right,
and we'll go on. How does he convince them that they've got to get on his side,
yeah,
and really believe and want to fight in this war? Because we're not talking about, you know, 2012, 2013, where you have volunteers going off and fighting, and 99% of America is not involved in the war, and they're going off to Iraq and Afghanistan, and yes, we're at war, but we're going on with our daily lives. In 1862, you had to actually get people to put on the uniform, and it was hard to do that.
This was like touching every family in the country in one way or another.
Yeah.
And it was a challenge. Lincoln, late in the year, talked openly about, you know, these people in the North, they think we're going to somehow win by strategy. And what is going to be required is hard, desperate fighting, was his expression. And so his annual message, which was a written document in those days, what we now call the State of the Union, he spent a lot of time on it in late November, early December of 1862. It's an extraordinary document because what he does, he goes back to first principles. He talks about the geography of our country. He talks about how impossible it is to draw peaceful boundaries, and he talks about the demography, he talks about the natural resources, and he says, look, here, if we can just get through this, if we can come together, if we can have this union, peaceful, protected by the oceans, sea to shining sea, 75 years from now, three generations, the United States can be richer than all of Europe put together, more prosperous, at peace. This is an extraordinary thing to say. Number one, to look that far out into the future, mm-hmm, you know. And number two, to say at a time when the sun didn't set on the British Empire and there was a French Empire, Belgian Empire, to say that the United States would be richer than all of Europe put together. But he was right. And so part of his genius as a politician, his greatness that he achieved, was not just the day-to-day ability to hold the Union coalition together, but to set this vision and say, here's why we need to do this.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with David Vondrell, whose book is called Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. By the way, David's going to be at Maryville University tonight for the Maryville Talks Books series. That'll be in the auditorium at 7 o'clock tonight, and he's going to speak about this and do a Q&A and then sign copies of the books that Left Bank Books will be there selling tonight, so you can go and hear much more about this. When you talk about the State of the Union address, or, you know, Lincoln's Gettysburg address or his inaugural addresses, all famous documents now, we think in terms of modern terms. You know, when Obama gives his inaugural address on Monday, people can watch and react instantly.
Right.
There was no radio. There was no TV. There were newspapers, but who read newspapers? A small quantity of Americans. So did most Americans even hear these inspirational words you're speaking of in the State of the Union address?
They actually did. There was you know, people were becoming readers. The mass newspaper was just coming in to its own, being invented by characters like James Gordon Bennett in New York, at the New York Herald. And they would pore over these papers, and part of it was the war that galvanized this. The people were desperate for news. I mean, this is how many people learned that their son, brother, father had been, husband had been killed, would be to see a name on a list in a newspaper.
Oh, really? They weren't notified in person, but saw it on newsprint?
They'd find it on newsprint.
Wow.
They were making it up all as they went along. But they did have one technology had come in, the telegraph. And it's part of what allowed Lincoln to really assert his presidential authority over the military for the first time in our history, really, was this machine that allowed him to communicate directly with generals who were off fighting distant battles. You know, mm-hmm. Prior to that, you know, they'd raise an army, they'd march away from Washington, and the president was sort of at sea.
Put a guy on a horse, send him back, you know how it's going.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. At the same time he's dealing with this, he's dealing with problems on his own personal home front. They're in the White House. He's got a wife, Mary, who's got severe mental health issues, mm-hmm. and a family that, their kids are, not healthy. Right. And I think, did Willie, one of his sons, die that year?
Willie died in February of 1862, and it was a crushing blow. One friend said of Lincoln, he was fonder of that boy than of anything or anyone in life. Mm. And Mary did it. Her grief was so extreme, she had a nervous breakdown. Lincoln was crushed by grief. And one of the things that started me on this book was just wondering how, physically and emotionally this man was able to endure this year. It's extraordinary. I mean, I would have cracked. He wasn't sleeping. He was wrestling with insomnia,
depression. Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. If my daughter died, I'm not coming to work the rest of the year.
Yeah.
I don't care, It's just the most depressing thing I can possibly imagine happening, right. Losing your child.
Right.
Well, here's a guy who is commander-in-chief. He's the president. He's got a government to run. He's got a nation to lead, a nation to heal. He can't say, I'm going to take a couple of days off, can he?
No. He would, for several months afterward, every Thursday. Willie died on a Thursday. Every Thursday, he would take a couple of hours and lock himself in the room where Willie died, and no one was allowed to disturb him while he sat and grieved. But, no, he didn't have this option. I think Lincoln was famously a very sad and lonely man, although he's always surrounded by people. His law partner called him the loneliest man who ever lived. And one of the things he learned from sadness is that the way to get through it is to put one foot in front of the other. He writes a beautiful letter at the end of 1862 to the daughter of a friend of his who had been killed in the war. And he says to her, "You're young. This is your first experience of grief. And so you think you're never going to feel better. But you will. You have to keep going. Take it from me. I know whereof I speak. I've been through it." And I think that's part of the way he survived this ordeal of the war, was that he had learned that really at an early age.
I've had friends who've lost children, and I don't know what to say to them to this day. I mean, I have a friend whose youngest son died 15 years ago, and to this day, I still have no word. I don't know how you talk about that with somebody, and I certainly don't know what it's like to be on the other side. I just know I'm not getting out of bed for a really, really long time. So this position he was in, this seemed odd. Now, one last thing I have to ask you about. We're going to have the inauguration on Monday, and, of course, security in Washington, D.C. will be on a par with what it was 4 years ago, right. Which was already historical. No precedent to the amount of security that was there because it's our first African-American president. And it'll be the same this Monday. When I saw Spielberg's movie, Lincoln, there are scenes of him. He gets in, a horse-drawn carriage, and he goes around Washington. He's going to go meet somebody. He drives, take me over to their house. And, he's going right through the streets. There's no security around him. There's no police. There's no armed guards. There's nothing. He's just going wherever he is. Is that what life was like in Washington, D.C. for the president? Like, nobody knew what the president looked like? There's not even a, hey, Abe?
People would stop and watch him go by. It drove Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, absolutely mad. He begged Lincoln to allow him to assign him a troop of cavalry. And Lincoln's reaction was, I have to see people. If somebody wants to kill me, they can kill me. He was very fatalistic about it. And so in the summer of 1862, they moved out to a house on the hill outside of Washington to escape the swamp that the White House was sitting in. And Lincoln would ride his horse back and forth from the summer White House to his office at the White House every day, twice a day, often by himself. There's one scene where apparently he and the vice president rode by themselves for 3.5 miles. Wow. It's extraordinary.
That is extraordinary. And your book is the damn good read. It's called Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln in America's Most Perilous Year. David will be at Maryville University tonight in the auditorium at 7 o'clock. Get there early. Get yourself a seat. Get a copy of the book from Left Bank Books. He'll do the talk and the Q&A and then sign a bunch of them afterwards. I hope it's a big success for you, and I hope the book is a big seller for you.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Thank you for coming in here. David Vondrell joining me here on the Big 550 KTRS.